couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Dr. Sleep, Last Christmas, Midway, Playing with Fire, and a look back at the original The Shining. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Snow Falling on Cedars. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Seth Meyers, the comedian, he's best known for having been on Saturday Night Live, but now he's on Late Night. And he has a Netflix special now, and the reason this hit my radar is because Seth Meyers is known for doing a lot of political jokes. Obviously, he's well known for Saturday Night Live, and he does Late Night. He also was infamous for having done the White House Correspondents' Dinner that during Obama's reign, and Trump was there, and he was making fun of Trump. And supposedly some people, and I don't know if this is true in any sense, but some people are suggesting that that's when Trump got the idea to run. It's kind of like, I'll show him, which I really don't think Trump's presidency is a grudge match against Seth Meyers. But there you go. You have your crazy conspiracy theories about it. But he's known for politics. And this is nothing new. It was a late night talk show hosts have been about politics all the time, and certainly Saturday Night Live has been about politics. Well, in this special, this stand-up special, he talks about everything from having kids to getting married, and he does brush on politics briefly. And so what he does is he this hit the news cycle where they said they're going to have a little button there that'll show up, and he actually calls it out in the special. He's like, it points to the wrong part of the screen, but he calls it out in the special. He says, we're going to have if you don't want to hear the political stuff, just hit this button and it'll skip past it, which I don't know. There's about 10 minutes of Trump jokes in there. And I saw that immediately. I said, well, this is a gimmick. This is a gimmick to get stories written about this before the special. It's a way to promote the special without having to beg people to promote the special. You give them something that's at least buzzworthy or newsworthy, saying, ooh, this new technology from Netflix. And that's really all it was. I really don't think that Seth Meyers is expecting people to skip it. At first, I wanted to watch it because I was curious. I thought what was going to happen is he was going to start the show that way and it was just going to skip to the end credits and it was all going to be political. It wasn't that. But it's a funny little, it's a joke. It's sort of an inside joke. But it brings up a bigger discussion. And that is this business of people getting upset when a comedian or an actor doesn't agree with them politically. If you think somebody's funny, generally, you just deal with what they throw at you. I never heard anybody on the conservative side, for example, suggest having a skip button during the Dave Chappelle special when he was very critical and got taken to task about what would be considered as transphobic and homophobic jokes, and he has very pro-Second Amendment jokes in there. I never thought anyone was saying, oh, you should have a skip button for that. And you shouldn't. You like your comedians, whoever the comedians are. That's just the way it is. What have we reduced ourselves to as a society that you're so thin-skinned, that you're such a, you know, borrow a term, snowflake, that you can't listen to somebody making fun of your guy? Look, I've watched Saturday Night Live, and I've watched political commentary and jokes here and there, and there's plenty of stuff to make fun of on both sides, even in very partisan times. I remember when Hasan Minhaj did the White House Correspondents' Dinner, he ripped apart MSNBC. Now, he's known for being on a relatively liberal show, which is The Daily Show, and he's known for being a relatively liberal comedian, but he said there's plenty of stuff to make fun of Rachel Maddow and Chris Matthews. Why can't you take it from both sides? And I remember going back in years ago in the 90s watching Dennis Miller on Saturday Night Live, and his bit is to find the absurdity in whatever's going on, whether it be on the left or the right. I was talking to my parents this week. I was mentioning the Baldwin brothers, and I was talking about Alec Baldwin and William Baldwin and Stephen Baldwin and Daniel Baldwin. And of course, Alec Baldwin, there's a lot of people who are conservative don't like Alec Baldwin because he's very outspoken, and he's kind of a brash a-hole. I mean, if you really just kind of look at his public persona, you know, take politics out, he's kind of a jerk. And my mom was like, oh, he's awful. He's terrible. And I go, well, there's a lot of terrible people in Hollywood. I do not judge a piece of art like a movie or a television show based on the politics or the personal niceties of the people involved. Now, if there's somebody who's like, I understand now that we've had this Me Too movement, I don't want to see anything done by Kevin Spacey or Harvey Weinstein, or, you know, I don't like to go back and watch stuff that O.J. Simpson's in because the guy's a freaking murderer. So I get that. Like, there are certain lines you can't cross, but if you're just a jerk or you disagree with me politically, I'm not going to not watch your stuff. It's if you're a good actor, you're a good actor. It doesn't matter what your politics are. And if you're funny, you're funny. You know, I don't know what the rest of the Baldwin brothers are, but I know where Alec Baldwin is coming from, and whether or not I agree with him or disagree with him, I'm not a big Alec Baldwin fan, but there's some roles that he's really good in. And he's weathered the storm and gotten old and fat and still gets parts, and he's able to do that. So I think, and this has been going on for a while, I think people just need to dial it back and say, hey, look, it doesn't matter what the person who's acting, and if they're just kind of a jerk. Now, if they're a criminal, that's different, but if they're just a jerk, or they're not particularly nice, or they're not particularly friendly, or if they disagree with you politically, it's absurd to not engage in the entertainment they produce. Because you're never going to agree with everybody. And I found that when entertainment tries to go directly and say, we're going to appeal to this audience because of this people's political views, usually that stuff stinks. So yeah, let's just calm down, people. Watch what you think's funny. If you want to watch a stand-up special, watch what you think's funny. If you want to be entertained, watch what you find entertaining. And it doesn't matter what the person's politics are. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That song means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is The Invisible Man, which opens on February 28th.
He cut his wrists. Per his final wishes, you're getting $5 million. Contingent, of course, on the fine print. He can't be ruled to be mentally incompetent.
I'm scared.
You don't have to be scared of him anymore.
He was a sociopath, completely in control of everything. He said that wherever I went, he would find me, walk right up to me, and I wouldn't be able to see him.
For the first time, this Universal Monsters reboot is actually looking like it might be a decent attempt, because this movie's looking like it's just telling a thriller, horror story, basically. It's telling a version of The Invisible Man, and it's updated, but it's about a guy who learns how to become invisible and goes insane. It's not trying to seed a huge dark universe and suddenly throw in Dr. Jekyll and Dracula and the whole thing. They're just telling a quaint little horror story, and I look forward to that. Speaking of horror, let's talk about The Color Out of Space, which I don't think has a release date yet, but I'm looking forward to it. It stars Nicolas Cage.
Then everything just blew up. Big flash, like a pink light. Or actually, I don't even know what color it was. It wasn't like any color I'd ever seen before. It
looks like a meteorite.
I mean, it's radioactive. I mean, it's from space, right?
Meteorites are generally no more dangerous than ordinary rocks.
Something that big just disappear. Did you plant those?
No.
This is based on an H.P. Lovecraft story, which is an infamous story. It's not one of his best known ones with the Cthulhu mythos, or, you know, it's not like The Call of Cthulhu. And I'm a huge Lovecraft fan. I'm curious to see what they do with this otherworldly approach. It's Richard Stanley who blows hot and cold for me. You know, he did Hardware and Dust Devil, which I thought weren't great movies. But I gotta say, this one looks like it might be pretty interesting. I'm going to have to go dig up my copy of Color Out of Space in my Lovecraft collection and read it before I see the movie, because I'm curious to see what the adaptation is going to be like. But this one has me on the hook. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Last Christmas and Playing with Fire. guys at the movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews with Last Christmas. A woman whose life is a bit of a mess works as an elf in an all-year Christmas store in London, and she falls in love with a man on the street she repeatedly runs into.
You have thrown away your life working in some silly Christmas shop.
Hey, elf!
This is my little helper.
I have nicknamed her Lazy the Elf because she appears never to work.
Whoa! You! Again.
What do you mean again?
Did you follow me here?
Are elves always so cynical?
Yes, relentlessly. These are dark times.
So what is it that you do?
I sing.
Oh, that's amazing.
Anyway, boring.
I'm not bored.
Okay, this one is a cheesy, schmaltzy, Hallmarky kind of Christmas movie. It stars Emilia Clarke as this woman playing an elf, and she's very well placed in this. I mean, she's adorable, she's cute, she's small. If you don't know who she's in, she's the naked blonde girl from Game of Thrones, only she's not naked in this. She's just blonde. But she's really adorable in this. And, you know, like I said, her life's a mess. I mean, she can't keep a solid relationship. She's having problems with her parents. And her parents, her mom is played by Emma Thompson, who helped write the script for this, which I think is kind of an interesting little tidbit. This isn't a really heavily artistic movie, which I think is kind of interesting. Usually when somebody like at the caliber of Emma Thompson is involved in writing a script, it's usually something significant. It's this. I wouldn't say this is significant. This is a sweet little cute Hallmark style movie put on the big screen. And it's exactly what you'd expect. For better or for worse. And here's the thing. Look, if you are not a fan of romantic comedies, if you're somebody who poo-poos that sort of cheesy representation of love, don't go see this movie. Don't be an idiot. It constantly annoys me when people go see a movie like, oh, I don't like romantic comedies. I like romantic comedies like Sideways. And you're like, that's really not a traditional romantic comedy. That's like saying, I like cheesy horror movies. Well, I like cheesy horror movies like Hereditary. And like, that's not a cheesy horror movie. That's a very serious horror movie. Cheesy horror movies, something like Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, with Tom Atkins and his wonderful mustache. Last Christmas is a lark. It's a romp. That's all it's meant to be. And I mean, it is just, it just reeks of Christmas too. Cause part of the thing is she works in the store, and the store, it literally looks like the North Pole threw up all over this store. It is insane. It's directed by Paul Feig. And that's an interesting thing to note because he's best known for doing stuff like Bridesmaids. Or he did the Ghostbusters remake. But this is not his typical improv comedy awkwardness that you got with those films. This is a little more tightly scripted. And this is following up A Simple Favor, which is what he did last year, which was one that was a little bit different than his normal fare. So it's neat to see Paul Feig stretching and experimenting and doing things other than just a rehash of Bridesmaids. And this movie is, it's a cute romantic comedy. It's got Henry Golding in it. He plays the love interest. And if you don't know who he was the guy, the love interest, the main guy in Crazy Rich Asians. Because Henry Golding is such an Asian name. And I'm not a big fan of his. He's a good looking guy, but it kind of ends there. He's like model type, but there's not a whole lot of, I don't feel any sort of depth or charisma about him. Now, conversely, Emilia Clarke, she's got charisma all over the place. She is just dripping with charisma. And she is what makes this movie better than just your run-of-the-mill rom-com. She is what makes it fun. She's adorable. And there are times when I'm just watching this movie and maybe I'm rolling my eyes at some of the stuff that goes on in it. But then I'm like, oh, well, that's kind of sweet. And she's really adorable. And oh, wait, I'm getting sucked in. Oh, no. And it is one of those movies that just kind of that Christmas cheer does kind of draw you into it. And it's all because of her. She is what carries the film. I found myself really enjoying it. Now, there's something interesting about it. And this has been going on. I wasn't going to talk about it this week, but it's been mentioned to me multiple times. Apparently, you know, there's like, you know, twists and surprises throughout most films. And there's something that goes on in this movie and people have made a big news story about it and people are talking about it and spoiling it. And I'm like, why are people spoiling a movie? And even like critics. And that's what I ripped somebody, a good friend of mine, I ripped him up on Twitter. He's like, well, is this the way this happens? And I go, I don't give spoilers. I certainly don't give spoilers for movies that aren't out yet. What kind of an a-hole does that? I mean, I never understood the appeal of giving away a movie. Even if it like even something like Apollo 13, where you're like, you know what happens, it's history. Well, maybe you don't particularly know that. You don't get to say that. I was once on TV with, and it's 127 hours is the movie I'm talking about. So if you don't want to hear this, you know, you turn off your radio for about 30 seconds. But I it was like when the movie came out and the TV host said, oh, is this a movie about the guy who cuts off his arm? I'm like, dude, that's the ending of the movie. And he's like, well, we know what it is. I'm like, you know what it is. But somebody watching the TV doesn't. The movie isn't even out yet. And that was what was, I cannot stand that. I cannot stand the entitled arrogance that people have to spoil a movie. And I've said this before. Spoiling a movie is like farting in an elevator at the dinner table. You may not care, but everybody else, it is offensive. Just keep your trap shut. Let people experience the movie as they experience, especially if it's not, and there's people out there on film Twitter who speculate and then they dismiss it and they go, oh, well, it's just a stupid romantic comedy. It doesn't matter. Clap back. It does not matter. Whether it's a rom-com, whether it's a horror film, whether it's a drama, whether it's a historical based on a true story, don't spoil the ending of a movie, you jerks. I don't care whether you're press or whether you're just poor schlub walking around. And people out there writing articles and talking about it, you're just as bad. You're all farting at the dinner table. With that said, I thought Last Christmas was rather charming. So I'm going to have to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. After that rant, let's talk about Playing with Fire. John Cena stars as a fire jumper who ends up taking care of three children saved from a wilderness fire.
Until we can get you back to your parents, I'm legally bound to take care of you, so that's what I'm going to do. Mama! And in turn,
you're going to be obedient so we can do our job. Come together now!
No shenanigans under my watch.
Me, Fireman, can't turn my neck.
What needs to happen this second is you got to watch your tone, little sister.
Or what?
Masher is coming to rock your world.
If I get distracted, I can't do this job effectively.
Don't you remember what it's like to be a kid?
I don't have much time in this segment because I was ranting. But this looks like John Cena is trying to do the same thing that Arnold Schwarzenegger did with like Kindergarten Cop or Dwayne Johnson did with the Game Plan and other films where they're trying to do the family audience stuff. Like Vin Diesel did this with The Pacifier. Doing family comedy that allows them to expand their audience and get fans at a young age. And this looks like a cute little family movie. Don't expect too much out of it. I mean, it's just a silly little lark of a film. And John Cena, I think, is really, his forte is comedy. And he's already done the comedies and he's done more grown-up comedies like Blockers or Trainwreck, but he also did Daddy's Home 2. He was involved in that. And I think he's fun. I think John Cena is a better comedic actor than he is a dramatic or action actor. And this might be kind of cute. I have to give it a preemptive suck because they didn't screen it. So we have that.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Shining and Dr. Sleep. To Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue with the movie reviews. And I'm actually going to go back and talk about the original film, The Shining, first. Because I really haven't talked about it. I remember talking about Room 237 a couple years ago when that was out. But this is the first time I've really had a chance to revisit The Shining and talk about it on the show. So this seems like a very appropriate time to do it. Based on Stephen King's classic novel, Jack Nicholson stars as a writer who becomes the caretaker of a haunted hotel in the Colorado Rockies.
Meet Jack Torrance.
I'm outlining a new writing project.
He's a writer looking for inspiration.
Lots of ideas. No good ones.
Meet Danny.
Wait, Mr. Torrance.
He's a kid looking for a dad.
There's hardly anybody to play with around here.
Jack just can't finish his book.
I don't want to sound melodramatic, but
There's no way to make it economically feasible.
Here's to 5 miserable months.
Now that trailer's that's the joke trailer. That's the one that this guy did online. He did this probably about 15 years ago, where he cut a trailer of The Shining to make it look like a sweet, inspirational family comedy. It's not. Let me tell you, it's not. Also, the thing is, there's no really good trailer of The Shining out there. The original trailer for The Shining was The Blood Elevator, and there is no dialogue, and it's just this weird, creepy music and scrolling text on screen. It's a great trailer to see. It does not play well on the radio. And what's interesting about The Shining, I have read the book. I read the book, God, like 30 years ago, so it's been a while since I've read it. But I've read the book, and I've seen the movie. And the Shining itself as a movie, I don't think was fully appreciated until the last 10 years. When it came out, it was an enigma. And Stephen King hated it. And while it did well, and a lot of people find it genuinely scary, there's a lot of uneven nature to the film. And I think people just didn't understand what Kubrick was doing. Because one of the things Kubrick was brilliant at was doing things and then not telling people about them. He had his reasons. He just never shared them with anybody. And that's what's so great about The Shining is when you watch it, over the last 30, 40 years, people have started to look at it deeper and say, whoa, this doesn't make sense, and that's interesting, and look at this impossible geography. And he never sat down and explained it to people. And I remember when Jordan Peele's Us came out earlier this year, I was like, don't explain Us. Don't explain it too much. Let people get it. And if they don't get it, let it sit there for 30 years, and then maybe people will get it. Same thing with The Lighthouse. It's a great movie out right now, and the director doesn't come out and explain everything about it. There's plenty of think pieces that try to, but, you know, it's okay to have something you can interpret. Now, this movie is just a straightforward story. It, like I said, it's real choppy. The dialogue's a little awkward. The pacing is weird. But the real thing about this is it's very unsettling. I recently rewatched it. I just watched it this past weekend for the first time in a couple of years. And even knowing all the little hints and ticks back and forth of things that disappear and clues in the background, it's still a fascinating movie to dissect. And it's a movie that teaches you to watch a movie, not just watch the story. And it's funny, my youngest son hadn't seen it. And I said, we're going to watch The Shining this week, but I'm going to teach you about watching a movie more than just the story of the film that it's presenting. And I'm showing him the things as he sees the stickers on the wall. And when he's talking to Tony, the dopey sticker is there from the Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. But when Tony's not there and he disappears, the sticker disappears. And I'm like, look at all these like subliminal notes here, and look at how the pattern on the carpet changes when the ghosts show up. I mean, it's real interesting to dissect. And that's, I think, what makes it endearing is our subconscious picks up on all that impossible geography and unsettling nature and subliminal messaging and the looks and the sexual imagery that's embedded into the film. And that's what makes this movie, even today, uncomfortable to watch, even though it's a relatively simple story and doesn't make a whole lot of pragmatic sense. But it's a brilliant movie, and I've really come to appreciate it. Not necessarily because I think Room 237 is a great dissection of The Shining. It just it's a good movie to watch because it challenges you to look for more stuff in the film. So I'm going to have to say The Shining totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with a review of Dr. Sleep. Little Danny Torrance has grown up and uses his psychic abilities to connect with a young teen who's being targeted by a death cult.
You're magic, like me.
I only met 2 or 3 people like us. They died. When I was a kid, I bumped into these things. I don't know about magic. I always called it The Shining.
The impressive thing about this, what I find most impressive, is this serves as a sequel to both the book and the movie. Anyone who knows anything about Stephen King knows that he absolutely hates the Stanley Kubrick version of The Shining. He hated the casting of Jack Nicholson. He hated the directing of Jack Nicholson, because you can tell Jack Nicholson is bonkers from frame one. And if you read the book, it's a slow descent into madness of the character of Jack Torrance. He also changes some things, and wildly huge differences in the end of the book versus the movie. And one of the things that Kubrick did with the original Shining is he would do things that you weren't supposed to do in a horror movie. Like there's a scene where Wendy is looking through the papers he had typed, the All Work and No Play Make Jack a Dull Boy. And I heard Stephen King talk about the once, and he was saying, well, you know, at this point, then you have somebody jump up behind. But then he doesn't have somebody jump up behind. You sneak behind with him, and so he ruins that scare moment. And I'm like, that's true. But that's because Kubrick didn't want to do just a cheesy jump scare. He chose to approach it differently, and there's a meaning to that. And there's a meaning to the fact that at the end of The Shining, one of the big changes is Dick Halloran, who's played by Scatman Crothers in the original movie, and I know I just talked about spoilers, but this plays into Dr. Sleep. He gets killed in there, but he's not killed in the book. And I think he did that because Kubrick is saying, you think this guy's going to come in and save the day, and he absolutely totally doesn't. And that was enough that would be unsettling to somebody because it's playing with your expectations. And Mike Flanagan, the director of Dr. Sleep, manages to make the sequel about both because he skips a lot of the details that are different. And he just attaches it to the fact that there's this haunted hotel in the middle of Colorado that made Danny Torrance's dad go bonkers. And he's able to use a lot of the imagery and the set designs and the music and the emotions and the feel of The Shining. The movie, he's able to do that into this film. But it takes a while to get there. 80% of the movie isn't about The Shining, isn't about the Overlook Hotel or the ghosts there. 80% of the movie is about this story with Danny Torrance connecting with this girl and this weird, creepy death cult that's going after her. And it's only at the end that you really get the big, because that's what everyone's waiting for. Everyone's waiting for the return to the Overlook. And that really works. I think there's some moments that are squandered at the end. I think that there's some things that Flanagan could have done because he does change things from the original book of Dr. Sleep. And so I'm like, well, if you could have changed that, you could have really done some neat stuff and you could have gone really big, but he didn't. And I guess that has its own worth, which is very much in line with The Shining. So there's some parts that I was a little disappointed at, but it's also still an unsettling movie. And I think it's a fair continuation of the characters and what's going on in the film and in the book. So I gotta say, I didn't love it, but I think it's something you can see. You don't have to go rewatch The Shining, even though I did. You just have to know that it's a haunted hotel that makes a guy go crazy. And I think you don't even have to have seen The Shining all the way through. You just have to be familiar with the imagery to understand this movie. I think it's actually kind of put itself out there and is very accessible to the average person. So overall, I'm going to say, even though I had some reservations, I still think Dr. Sleep kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Midway, the box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Snow Falling on Cedars. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. Well, this isn't even a movie review. This is going to be a preview. Because like Playing with Fire, this was not previewed or screened for me. And what's interesting about these movies that don't get screened, sometimes I get a chance to go check them out on like a Thursday night. The problem is we're getting to November, December time. And one of the things about this time of year in particular is it is a flood of screenings for us critics, because what ends up happening, and this is a little bit inside baseball of this, but what ends up happening is this: the studios all have these movies that they want the critics to see right before they make their award selection and nominations. By mid-December, they've all sent us discs and screeners for this anyways, but they're intent on having people see them in the theater, even though you're going to get the screener. But what ends up happening is they have all these movies, and then every studio tries to screen everything in a 2 or 3 week period. And most critics aren't critics full time. Most critics have a day job. There's a lot of people who work during the day, or they're taking care of kids during the day, or they're a housewife or a house husband or something during the day. And they don't have time to, they need to get a babysitter to go in the middle of the day for a screening. So what ends up happening is our nights fill up. You go in a 7 o'clock screening on a Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and a Thursday. And I couldn't go see a movie this Thursday because I had to go see another movie that they wanted me to watch before it was released for award consideration. So it gets very crowded, and then suddenly everyone's just like, oh, we don't have enough room. And then like a week or two later, we get a screener disc. That's probably not going to happen with Midway, because I don't feel like there's any sort of awards push for this one. Midway is a film about a group of military men trying to protect the country and retaliate against Japanese after Pearl Harbor.
Pearl Harbor is the greatest intelligence failure in American history.
Reset! Fire!
The Japanese are planning something bigger.
So what's the target?
We believe it's Midway.
Washington disagrees.
Washington is wrong.
This is about a monumental point in the American military history. It's right after Pearl Harbor, and it's about the Battle of Midway, about the U.S. military trying to figure out where the Japanese are coming from next, because they've declared war, they attacked Pearl Harbor, and they got to get their craft together. So many the ships and planes got destroyed in trying to, you know, set things up and protect the borders of the U.S. And it's directed by Roland Emmerich. And Roland Emmerich, he's great with spectacle. He did, of course, the Independence Day movies, and he did Stargate, and he did Godzilla in the 90s. And he's pulled back and done more intimate pieces, like he did that Anonymous, which was that Shakespeare, like if Shakespeare didn't write his own plays movie. And those are fine movies, and that works for what he's doing. But I don't know if he's going to do spectacle of like realistic spectacle. Part of the problem they didn't screen it for us. Again, probably because it's not that good, but they didn't screen it for me locally. And my only guess is that from watching the trailers, the visual effects don't quite look up to snuff. It looks like everything's done on a blue screen, which it absolutely is. And there's a danger in doing a realistic movie like this. And I was explaining this to somebody once. I said, the problem is if you do a movie like The Avengers and you got Thanos showing up in a ship, you don't know what Thanos' ship would really look like. You don't know what Thanos would really look like. He's a purple alien. It looks like Homer Simpson. But people can go to the Smithsonian and see what a plane looks like. And people can go to an airport and see what planes look like and see how they behave and how they move in the air. We can see that. We can observe that with our own eyes. And we know what sky looks like, and we know what the ocean looks like. A good chunk of us have actually been to the ocean to see, maybe not in battle, but we know what smoke looks like. We know what explosions look like. So making something that's a real practical thing that people can see in their experience makes it very, very hard to match with digital technology. And that's, I think, where you're going to have a problem. Plus, they tend to rush stuff in a movie. If you have too many special effects, you may end up with not as good of special effects because you got to cram all those down. And it looks like they're going to be doing a lot of action in this movie. And so when you have aliens in Independence Day, you can do what you want with those, but you got to make these look photorealistic to what it was like in World War II. Anyways, this wasn't screened, so I'm going to have to say it gets a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office from last week. And The Terminator won the weekend. That is correct. But it still flopped. The Terminator brought in less than $30 million. It made $2 million more than it was predicted at like $27 million. But still, $29 million for a reboot of the franchise, which they've tried four times in the past. It's certainly one of the lowest box office for a Terminator opening sequel adjusted for inflation this movie is, this is effectively terminating the franchise. If they couldn't reboot it this time, it wasn't going to happen. And what I found interesting is there were all these people that were bemoaning the fact, oh, people didn't want to see it because they're a bunch of sexists. And I'm like, if you've watched any of the Terminator, the first two Terminator movies are full of female, strong female heroines. It's not that there are women in the lead roles in this movie, because you can't even say that there was a Terminator that was, we had a female Terminator in the third one. It's because it was a crummy story and it didn't work. And I think people are done with the Terminator series and they just want it to die for a while. Joker's still out there doing great. It's almost going to, it's crossed $300 million before I even finished talking. And then Maleficent came in third with $85 million, which isn't very good for it either. Harriet was in number four, did $11 million. That's not bad. And then it's all kind of downhill from there. This week, of course, it's going to be Dr. Sleep that's going to be the big one. It'll be interesting to see what that ends up being when the box office rolls in on Monday. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the home cinema roundup. The feature this week that I'm spotlighting is Snow Falling on Cedars. It's the collector's edition from Shout Select. It's a 20th anniversary of the movie as well. And in the movie, in the early 1950s, a Japanese man is accused of killing a boat captain, and his wife's ex-lover writes about the trial in the local paper.
You smell like cedar.
So do you.
I knew we could never be right together, and that soon I would have to tell you so.
She's married, Ishmael.
Kara Hina is dead. It's all over the island.
You've been arrested.
We have no answer. You sit there in silence.
This trial is wrong. The whole thing is unfair.
Well, maybe I should write an article about all the unfair things people do to each other.
That's the thing with girls. They grow up and break your heart.
This is not what I normally get from Shout Factory. A lot of times I get the more genre vintage movies, horror movies, and science fiction. This is a more serious film. It's based on basically a book club book. My mom, I was telling my mom I got this Blu-ray, and she's like, oh, I read the book in my book club in the 90s. And I'm like, okay, that's great. It is very clear that it is an adaptation of a book, because the presentation and the pacing of the movie feels like it's a book. It feels like it's a evolving, rotating narrative. At times, it's it takes place in this trial, and then it flashes back to when they're kids, and the Ethan Hawke's character is flirting and fooling around with the Japanese wife when she was younger, and it moves. You almost don't know what time it is until you can settle on what's happening. When you're in a trial, you're like, okay, I'm in the trial, but if we're around town, you have to use context clues to figure out. Sometimes it's disorienting at times to kind of figure out where in the past this is happening. And I get that. I understand them doing that. It just makes it a difficult movie to watch, and it's a little bit hard to deconstruct. And when you watch it, you're like, oh, this is about this trial. Oh, no, it's not about this trial. It's about this love story. That really isn't a love story. It's a love story when they're kids, and it's more them reacting to the fact that they were once in love and they had a rough breakup when he went to war. I mean, the movie's a beautiful-looking movie. It's beautifully shot, and I believe it won an Academy Award, or was nominated for an Academy Award. But, I mean, it's a very serious drama, a little bit slow-moving. I wasn't a huge fan, but then again, I'm not a big book club kind of guy. Anyways, there's also some special features on here, including a new transfer, which actually they fix a lot of the cinematography issues that were on the DVD and VHS tapes. But it also has a new look back. It's like an hour behind the scenes documentary of the movie. It's got the auto commentary with the director and a spotlight on location, which is a vintage featurette, and then some deleted scenes in the trailer. So it's a nice little collector's edition if you're a fan of the movie. But for me, I was just kind of so-so. I'm going to have to say, actually, I thought it kind of sucked.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
Other releases this week include Hobbs and Shaw, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, which should have come out a couple weeks ago at Halloween, The Kitchen, and The Art of Racing in the Rain. And that is it. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Charlie's Angels and The Report. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.